Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Glenn and Helen Show. It's been a busy week with the anniversary of the London bombings, a report of a foiled terror plot in New York, rumblings in Iran, events in Iraq, and, of course, the biggest story of all, multiple missile launches in North Korea.
We've got our two favorite military experts, Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan, on the phone, and they're going to help us sort out what's going on.
Well, on the phone with us now, we've got Jim Dunnigan. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
And we've got Austin Bay.
Hi, Glenn. Hi, Helen.
Hey. Thank you all so much for joining us. Our first question today is we want to know what's going on with North Korea, because they seem better at launching missiles than at getting them to go where they want. Should we be worried about this?
Well, missiles are the least of their problems. The major problem in North Korea is one, that the economy isn't working, has not been, well, I guess you could say for two generations, but ever since the Soviet Union collapsed and the subsidies disappeared, as we all know, they've been literally starving to death. That in itself is not a real problem for a police state, except for the fact that information on the outside world is getting in, and that is making people upset. There's a record number of North Koreans reaching South Korea, where they have to go a very circuitous route. It's usually through China and then some other country that will, let them go to South Korea. And they tell a tale that is something out of fiction. I mean, it doesn't sound real, but it is. And the problem is that the control that the people in North Korea, the leadership, as it were, has over the people is cracking and slipping away. And what China is most worried about is total collapse and millions of refugees coming across the border. What the South Koreans are worried about is the same thing, because they know what happened to West Germany when they had to absorb East Germany. So I know it sounds cynical and heartless, but everybody over there wants the North Korean, dictators to stay in power. The problem is the Kim and the rest of his cronies seem to be unable to do even that.
I'd add, besides their own teetering internal situation, even though it can teeter in this manner, a Stalinist teetering for years, is that I believe that there's Pyongyang, the North Korean government, is concerned that there are changes in China, in Chinese toleration of their own regime. And as Jim touched on the issue of refugees, the Chinese have seen influxes of North Koreans escaping North Korea. They move into northern Chinese provinces. They don't want the influx to become a tidal wave. They've seen that happen. And we've seen that happen in other places on the planet. Jim is precisely right about the South Korean concern. The South Koreans don't want to be West Germany taking over the debts of East Germany. And the West German economy has been sclerotic for 15 years. The South Koreans don't know that they want to pay the same kind of price.
It's cost the West Germans over $1 trillion
so far.
Well,
it wouldn't be a 15-year project with North Korea, because East Germany was maybe only three decades behind West Germany. North Korea, as Jim has said, has kind of slipped into pre-agricultural revolution. No, they're in the agricultural revolution with nuclear weapons. In other words, they're a century behind South Korea, if not more. But Helen, your question is, should we be worried when you have a regime that is threatened, that has lost its traditional sources of support, and that was first Russia, as Jim pointed out, when it was still a Soviet Union, is concerned about its relationship with China, when they have ballistic missiles, and you don't need a Taepodong 2 to damage the entire globe's economy. All you got to do is be able to shoot Seoul and Tokyo, and they can already do that. And then you add nuclear weapons. Yes, you have reasons for concern.
I think the one thing to keep an eye on is the main difference between the United States attitude towards North Korea and the South Korean, and largely the Chinese difference. We look upon the North Koreans as dangerous to us because they might sell either chemical weapons, which they have, or if they get nukes, sell nukes to terrorists. And the South Koreans and the Chinese dismiss that, because they believe that the North Koreans may be crazy, you know, more Groucho Marx than Karl Marx, but they don't think the North Koreans are suicidal. And, you know, I've argued this with South Koreans, and they make a good point. North Korea has done a lot of crazy things, but never suicidal. Of course, we're not as trusting, you know, and that is the major, you know, point of dispute. The South Koreans are willing to go along with the craziness up north until it basically collapses or they have a leveraged buyout, whatever it takes in order to resolve the situation up there. But the United States, you know, we're worried about the terrorism, and as long as you have somebody like North Korea who will sell weapons to anyone, you know, what's to prevent them from selling, you know, anthrax or, you know, sarin or nuclear material? That doesn't even have to be a bomb. They desperately need money, and they're basically telling us either give us money or we may do something crazy. And it's just a question of how crazy do you think they can get?
Well, they've been involved specifically in heroin trading, hard drug trading. They've also been implicated in their...
Counterfeiting.
I was going to say several organized criminal...
In one case, when they got caught, they demanded their counterfeit money back.
That's correct. you'll find articles on this beginning in the mid-1990s. I want to say 94, 95, 96, covering North Korean... illegal money-making activities, and as Jim is correct to point out, that if they can sell a nuclear weapon and believe they are not going to pay too heavy a diplomatic price, if they
don't
get away with it, don't get caught. I mean, that is because there's the step towards the quote-unquote suicidal act that the South Koreans argue the North Koreans are not suicidal if they're caught selling an Islamo-fascist organization a functional nuclear weapon. That is, now we're into the gray shadow of a suicidal act. Let me shift slightly from the United States perspective and move to another critical player, and that is the Japanese perspective.
Absolutely.
And understand that this is a kaleidoscope where one part shifts and another part reacts. Japan reacted very, very strongly to the 1998 surprise test of the earlier generation Taepodong intermediate-range ballistic missile that was tested in August of 1998.
And worked.
It scared them. Yes, it did. It worked. Japan was bracketed, as I recall, one stage fell in the Sea of Japan. Isn't this right, Jim? One fell in the Sea of Japan,
exactly.
The other one actually made it over the Pacific, so they're bracketed. And the Japanese... First of all, it ended the discussion for the most part inside Japan as if do we need to continue this close bilateral defense relationship with the United States. The smart, long-range thinking Japanese said it's not simply North Korea, it's also China, which is rearming, and there is no one else out there who is a counterweight to China militarily. Well, wait a minute. This bilateral defense relationship with the United States, it's the most important thing that defense relationship Japan has. And so you can see really since 99, 2000, and accelerating in 2001, Japanese-U.S. defense cooperation, and particularly in anti-ballistic missile defense. This is not something the Chinese want to see this reinvigorated Japanese-U.S. relationship.
Well, the Chinese prefer their Japanese vulnerable. And, of course, the other problem is that the baby boomer generation in Japan is all of a sudden become aware, especially in the last few years in China where there were riots. They always knew the Koreans hated them. But now they've been reminded that the Chinese hate them. And then when they looked around, they realized everybody hates them. And it's not just because they're Japanese, although their customs, you know, can be unpleasant no matter what their history. But most people in the region remember World War II. And, of course, the Chinese remember even before that, as do the Koreans. So the Japanese have to take into account the fact that they can't buy their way out of this. They may have to fight their way out of some future unpleasantness, which means weapons. Which, of course, makes everybody in the neighborhood nervous. Say, hey, see, we told you. They're a bunch of militaristic wackos. Anyway, what goes around comes around, and the Japanese are rearming.
and you keep pushing them, the big threat as far as the Chinese see, and this is why attitudes may be mellowing, if I can appropriate George Kennan's word about the Soviet Union in China towards dealing with North Korea, is do you want Japan to nuclearize?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want, and how long, Jim, how long would it take the Japanese to build a functioning nuclear weapon if they decided to do it right?
For over 10 years, they've been joking it would take 6 months or less.
I think it would probably, you could measure it in months, and the Japanese weapon would work and would be mated with a delivery system that would be very, very accurate. And it's not going to be aimed at Washington. It's not going to be aimed at Hawaii this time. It would be aimed at targets in Northeast Asia, because that would be in a deterrent force that China does not want to see. I don't think it's anybody, even the Japanese, that want to see a nuclear-armed Japan, but that is a component, that is a fear, an element that's at play in the diplomatic dance around North Korea.
Well, the Chinese have been very careful with the Japanese in terms of not pushing them into going nuclear. But what the Chinese cannot control is the North Koreans, which is why currently the Chinese are putting a lot more pressure on the North Koreans than they have in the past. And, of course, the North Koreans have done two things recently. One, they've been excoriating in private the Chinese for being false communists. And secondly, that we ran that bit about how they're stealing the Chinese trains that the aid is coming in on. Another email from my source in northern China, this morning, and he says, well, it's all hush-hush and what have you, but it appears that the trains are being returned reluctantly. So the Chinese are dealing with people that they perceive as out of control, and if the Chinese can't handle them, who can?
Well, speaking of crazy... Well, actually, before we get there, there's an interesting dynamic I sort of see here. It's almost as if Japan is now beginning to play the role, vis-a-vis the United States and Asia, that Britain has played with the United States and Europe.
Yeah, the semi-outsider.
Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting dynamic.
They're both islands. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
Yeah, except we've never invaded and burned down half of Europe. And that's an important difference. The Japanese are very widely and strongly disliked.
Well,
in Asia, in East Asia,
and with plenty of reason. I mean, they were pretty
exactly. But the thing is, Americans tend to think, like bygones be bygones. Time will heal our wounds. It doesn't work that way over there. It just makes them fester. They get worse. And I don't know how we're going to, I mean, the adult supervision in these countries, tries to deal with this, but as the Chinese found out last year, over the last 2 years, it can blow up in your face. There's a lot of residual ill will towards Japan, and if you give the population in general, any sort of a lead, they're going to just start burning down Chinese embassies and doing all sorts of nastiness, to express their displeasure.
Well, let me get to the crazy people connection now. Is there any coordination on this stuff between Iran and North Korea? Because it certainly seems like the North Koreans tend to get frisky whenever the heat is on Iran.
I don't think there's any conscious coordination. You got to remember that both countries are run by whack jobs. At different flavors.
Is that a technical foreign relations term?
Whack job?
Yeah.
Well, it's not quite in the dictionary yet, but I think it's up and coming.
It's one that we use on strategy page to describe them, and
we're trendsetters, right? Give it another 5 years, they'll be talking that way. Actually, offline they talk that way in Foggy Bottom. I've heard people, from the State Department, but I don't think it's gotten into any communiques yet. But it's only a matter of time.
I will say that I believe that there is evidence that, of course, Iran and North Korea and other rogue states at one time, you would include Libya and Iraq in that group.
South Africa.
And South Africa.
Right.
I was getting there. Possibly
Taiwan.
Taiwan, yes, I'm going there. Would have connections on weapons, electronics, and the like. I see North Korea, and I'm trying to remember the website that I saw this, it was... echoed something that I had thought, that North Korea thinks Iran gets all the attention. Iran has oil. North Korea does not. We've got to throw a tantrum and attract attention to ourselves. And in that sense, it's if the Iranians receive special dispensation or special attention, and the North Koreans say, hey, wait a minute, we've already got a bomb and we've got delivery systems, that's the kind of tentative connection or whack job connection that Jim was talking about. But it's certainly taking diplomatic cues from one another, whether it's worked out at a conspiratorial level. I don't see any evidence of that.
Well, as far back as the Korean War and before the Korean War, I know years ago I spoke to a fellow who had been in Korea after World War II, and they ran into the North Koreans then, and he says they were very prickly, very easy to take offense. And this is right after the war; they defeated the hated Japanese. There was a sort of good spirit in the air, but he says they were very prickly and they never got any better. So I've asked Koreans I know, South Koreans, I said, this is a Korean characteristic, and they sort of look at me and they think of it and they say, well, not really. So there's something in the water up there that has made the North Koreans, very touchy, even when you're trying to give them something. Remember, what they're really doing with all these negotiations is extorting us. Mm-hmm. They're running an extortion racket. And all we're arguing over is, how much do we pay you?
Why do people go along with these extortion rackets? It seems like the U.S. and other places that really follow diplomatic sorts of ways of negotiation really follow right along and play
into
the hands of
people. Well, but it's always
been
a problem in that kind of diplomacy is getting somebody who's bought to stay bought. And the North Koreans have, among their other problems, shown themselves to be very unreliable in that department. But you can live with that. That's why it really comes down to this disagreement between the United States and South Korea over just how extreme can the North Koreans be. Now, and I tell North Korea, I said, look, after 9/11, you talk about maybe getting shelled, by the Imangun, the North Korean armed forces, if they attack again. Well, you haven't seen that for over 50 years. Down in New York, you can still smell it down there. So it's fresh in our mind. And the South Koreans, they say, well, all right, you got a point there. But the North Koreans know. They're very afraid of America. They know that given any halfway decent reason, we would just, turn them into a parking lot. And the South Koreans really believe, and they do, and the South Koreans, you gotta remember, South Koreans have hundreds, thousands of people in North Korea all the time, because they're setting up these economic, maquiladoras and things like that, these manufacturing sites.
Aren't they also working on improving the roads too, or is that?
Oh yeah, they're doing it. They have a lot of people up there who have been, tutored in how to be diplomatic, how not to set them off, but they do establish relationships. And this is a source of a lot of the information I'm getting for it. We get a strategy page. I know a lot of South Koreans, and I've emailed, discussed with people who've been up there, and they tell me that, look, once you get to know them, they're more afraid of us than we should be of them.
I'd like to add one thing, Helen and Glenn, if I might, and it's not at all tangential to a discussion of North Korean missiles, and that is the necessity of having some type of thin shield anti-ballistic missile system, and we have not seen it used yet. The missile defense, the Continental Missile Defense System, I hope we never have to see it used, but the thin shield that we have now in place, remember at one time that was one of the greatest of political arguments domestically and internationally of the 1972 ABM treaty. Technology rendered that treaty dead, in my opinion, certainly by the mid 1980s. And what we need to be able to stop is a 6 to 12 missile pulse. I think we saw one of those on July the 5th, Asia time, July the 4th, U.S. Continental time, and they fired 7 missiles. And the reason I say 6 to 12 missiles, I can speak from personal scuttlebutt rumor. I worked in the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization as a reservist for 4 years in 1995 to 1999. And discussing with other officers who were in the section that I was working in, there was no way we were going to be able to stop the 1980s thermonuclear type exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States. But looking at Saddam's capabilities and projected North Korean capabilities, we've got to have a system that's going to be able to stop, 6 to 12 missiles. And then earlier this week, I think I saw that kind of pulse. Anyway, and it's what's your defense?
Well, what we're actually doing is creating another very high-priced export item, because the Japanese are already investing billions of dollars into the Aegis anti-missile system. We've sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of missiles, Patriot anti-missile missiles, to South Korea and various other allies, the Japanese. They're the ones who need it more than we do.
Well, I guess it's all about, getting some foreign exchange going as well as everything else. Well, let's turn to some other stuff here. It's the anniversary of the London subway bombings, and we just learned today that the authorities seem to have foiled a plot to blow up the Holland Tunnel in New York, which apparently had the goal of flooding Manhattan, which I don't quite understand.
That would not work.
But
Jim, that's down in your neighborhood, buddy.
Yeah.
I know, but I mean, I know engineers who know the tunnel very well, and I went through this the last time back in the 90s when there was a plot, actually a fairly advanced plot. They raided them as they were mixing up the, the potassium, the nitrates, explosive slurry. So they caught that one in the nick of time. That wouldn't work. But what this recent story has brought out is the fact that for terrorists, technology is not their friend. I mean, perhaps I shouldn't say this, but the Internet has not been the biggest boon to terrorists. It's been the biggest bane. The intelligence community loves the way the terrorists use the Internet, because it gives them an excellent way to keep an eye on them. Now, I won't go into detail on that.
What, you're not the New York Times?
The strategy page explaining, in round terms, how it works. But the Al-Qaeda, since it is not a disciplined organization, the only place they can really talk and get things going is on the Internet. And apparently they went a little too far on the Internet with their planning and got caught with this deal, with the tunnel.
What it does show is the degree of ideological delusion, well-propelled ideological delusion, that Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda affiliates possess, that a will to destroy New York, Washington, icon targets has not been diminished. However, what has improved is our ability to detect their plots, because we're looking now, and our ability to act to stymie them. I don't know about the finances anymore, though. I know that we had a better grip on that, I think, until a couple of weeks ago.
Well, what I've seen of the finances over the last, 10 years that I've been covering this, is that it's always been a hard scrabble operation. They talked in the early days. I was writing about it. Bin Laden was supposed to be a multimillionaire. Well, it turns out most of his money got stolen by guys who were even, nastier than he was, especially in the Sudan, some joint ventures which were mainly concerned with picking his pockets. And they've always been, and a lot of the information that has been picked up since then has shown that they're constantly squabbling about relatively small amounts of money. And basically, what any Islamic terrorist group has to do now is the first thing you do is raise some money. Credit card fraud, any kind of criminal activity or even legitimate activity, you need the cash. And you don't need much of it, but without any of it, you're not going to go anywhere. Now, what the British have been finding out, since the British MI5 has been keeping their ears to the ground much more so than they were, a year ago, is that there is a lot of plotting going on out there. It's quite scary. And, of course, MI5 has a problem in Britain, because the Brits, since they're corrupted by that European attitude of, oh, don't worry about it, manana, whatever. But MI5 keeps telling them, and apparently they get through to the people, the politicians who have a high enough security clearance where they can show them the raw data or listen to the recordings. They say, my God, we have some real whack jobs in this country. There's that term again. They're all over the place. The only positive news is that they are inept wackos, but they are people with murderous intent.
Do you think there are fewer of them now, or do you think that they're just stupider?
It's hard to say. I've been hearing from people in the Middle East that there are countries like Kuwait and Iraq and Saudi Arabia, that there are fewer Arabs you know, in those areas, which are 100% Arab, that are really breathing fire and intent on destroying the United States. They've seen reality. they've had Al-Qaeda operating in their own backyard. But as many European intelligence officials have been saying, it's getting worse the farther away you get from the Middle East. In other words, these expatriate communities. And I've seen that years ago in New York City. The biggest supporters of the IRA during the Troubles, you know, that 20 years of IRA bombing in Britain, was right here in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And I walk by bars and I hear Irish Americans singing these Irish IRA songs, mm-hmm. and I cringe. In fact, I had Irish people working for Irish, a couple Irish gals working for me as accountants, and they cringed even more so because they consider the IRA to be a bunch of terrorists. But over here, these Irish-American yobos, you know, consider them heroes and were giving them money.
You know, they would collect for NORAID at the bars
yeah.
in Boston
yeah.
and New York. And
I actually saw that. In fact, another good friend of mine was an assistant U.S. attorney. And for years, I probably still can't mention his name, for years he held down the IRA desk. So occasionally I get a somewhat sanitized, hopefully not too compromising, briefing on what was going on. But it was very real and it was very big. And what people are seeing is the same thing happening with the 20 million, you know, Muslims in Europe, where the youngsters are full of fire and willing to go so far as to actually kill people, as we saw a year ago in Great Britain.
Well, there are two things going on. One reason for the radicalization in Europe, and to some degree that in North America as well, I say North America, obviously including Canada and the United States, are the radical Sunni schools, madrasas, that had been funded
by
Islamic charities, but at Middle Eastern donors, wealthy Middle Eastern donors, and these act as a place for young Muslim men, predominantly living in a society where they don't feel they're getting a fair shake, or they're 19 years old, 18 years old, and are going through this standard youth identity crisis. And here is an identity for them to adopt, and one that they can blame other forces, capitalism, the United States, Great Britain, 12th century crusaders.
So the culture of grievance, I call it.
Well, yeah, that is. Yeah. And it is a culture of grievance. That is part of the attractor there. Now, to get back to the Middle East, this runs contrary to what you see on the lead articles of many of the national newspapers, but you can see this in what Jim and Al Nofi and I have been writing for strategypage.com. Iraq has acted, really, had a dampening effect on radicalization and recruitment in Arab communities, as Jim was mentioning, Kuwait, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, because they've seen what Al-Qaeda is firsthand, the savagery of the insurgency in Iraq, but the general overall success of U.S. forces. Now, I'm not discussing here Gaza and Hamas and the Israeli-Palestinian situation, but looking at the quote-unquote object lesson that Al-Qaeda fighting, waging a war in the heart of the Arab Muslim Middle East, what it's done, Al-Qaeda itself hurt itself in terms of ideologically and in terms of recruitment and politically by fighting in Iraq. To some, it's counterintuitive, but that, I believe, is one of the benefits for actually taking the war to the heart of the problem.
And there's other things that never get reported in the Western press but are big news over there, and that is Arab problem. In other words, why are we so much less successful than, say, Malaysia? We're not talking Muslim problem, but the Arab problem. Taiwan, Singapore, countries that have no natural resources, that
South
started
Korea.
Out as poor as South Korea.
Korea,
that started out as poor as we were, even more poverty-stricken, you know, 50 years ago, and are now surpassing us. And this has become a big topic of conversation, and it literally in many countries it's dwarfing the Arab fundamentalism. They consider the Islamic fundamentalists. They consider the Islamic fundamentalists part of the problem.
Well, good. Let me ask you. I notice in Iraq it looks as if Maliki is actually starting to bring some of the militias under control, and I wonder if we're going to see a move against Sadr and some of the Shiite radicals, or what's going on there now?
Well, what he's playing, he's got two sides after him. The Sunnis who are willing to cut a deal say, you got to stop these death squads from killing us. And in many cases, it's very personal because a lot of these death squads are going after senior Sunni Arabs, you know, prominent Sunni Arabs, who are the same ones who are negotiating with the government. So their negotiations are very, heartfelt, as it were. The other problem is that the Sadr, especially Sadr, but even the Bader crowd, they have problems with their extremists. They have their own extremists. And apparently what's going on right now, Sadr has made a deal with the Iraqi government. He's giving up his extremists. And that's what the shooting was all about, apparently, this morning. He stood aside and said, this guy, he's too extreme, even by my standards. You can go get him. We won't snipe at you from the sidelines.
In my view, the squeeze on Muqtada Sadr really began sometime last fall and then accelerated after December 2005, indications that one of the chief indicators was what Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani was telling the Shia parties and the secular parties, where he has some influence about encouraging the formation of the government. And one of the continual problems was the Muqtada Sadr's Mahdi militia. I think if you look back towards the end of March, and for some reason I think the battle took place on the 25th or 26th of March, that's off the top of my head, where Iraqi commandos with some support from U.S. forces got in a gun battle in Baghdad, and Muqtada Sadr's associates claimed that it was an assault on one of their mosques, but what it turned out to be was at least a dozen of the worst of the Mahdi militia died in a battle with the Iraqi police and Iraqi paramilitary, Iraqi security forces. And there the squeeze was on to eliminate your radical militarist wing of the Mahdi militia, and you've got a choice now, Muqtada. You can become a politician, or you can lose and be you'll lose as a street fighting man. But I think it was at the end of March that point was really made.
Sadr has been trying to reposition himself as a politician, but he has a big problem in that he's too young. He feels very intimidated by the graybeard. He's a guy in his 30s. And you have to really be at least twice that age to, you know, become a player in Iraqi politics. And although he comes from an illustrious family, his father was a martyr and all that, he simply hasn't got the personal stature. And that's something that we have been dancing around, and apparently the Iraqi government has been going out of its way to, turn him into an old man.
Let's turn to another topic now. What's going on in Afghanistan these days? You don't hear much about that anymore.
Taliban is losing, but nobody knows it. They've been trying to position themselves as the friend of the poppy-growing, farmer, and that's been somewhat successful, but long-term, that's a losing, proposition. They've been trying to take on the Afghan army and police. In combat, they've been losing, even when the Americans are not around. When the Americans are around, it's a wipeout. That's why you're seeing all these lopsided battles, three dozen Taliban dead, two wounded Americans. They've been attempting to do an Iraqi on us with roadside bombs and suicide bombs. Well, we did a piece in the strategy page just the last week, showing the statistics on that. Most of their suicide bomber attacks only kill the suicide bombers. That's not very efficient. Most of the roadside bombs, same thing. They've been killing mostly civilians. because they just haven't quite got the techniques down so far. So basically, they're the terrorists who can't terrorize straight. The problem is they are good at grabbing headlines. We won't really see, you know, the end to this until the campaigning season ends around September, October, and they go into winter quarters. But I would say that it's going to be, in the final tally, a very disappointing, you know, season for the Taliban, and it's really more a matter of Pushtun tribal politics than anything else. But that, I don't think, is going to make any noise in the mainstream media for at least another year. I mean, how many stories have you read in Strategy Page First? But the trouble with being ahead of the curve is nobody pays any attention to you, even though you're hot on the story before anybody else's. But that's basically what's going on in Afghanistan. The basic problem with Afghanistan, it's turning into Colombia, which is not good.
If the bomb goes off in Kabul, they have a success because they get a headline.
Exactly.
Well, thank
you. It's just like they say, it's like that old military wisdom. You march to the sound of the cannon. That's how a journalist operates these days.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. We really appreciate you for being here, and we'll have you back again. And people should check out Strategy
Pack. Thank you. Glad to help.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. I love having those guys on because it gives us information that we normally wouldn't hear from the mainstream media or regular newspapers.
Yeah, they know a lot, and they're certainly not shy about sharing their expertise.
No, you can hardly get a word in edgewise.
I actually like that. In fact,
makes my job easier, right?
Yeah,
both of our jobs.
Well, you know what inspired me to have them for guests was actually when I was in New York last year, I had breakfast with the two of them and just sat there listening to them talk. And it was basically exactly like these interviews. I'd get a little question in every once in a while, but mostly they just went back and forth. And I listened to it and said, these guys ought to be on the radio. And, well, we're doing the best we can here. You can check their stuff out when you're not listening to our podcast at strategypage.com or at Austin Bay's blog, austinbay.net/blog. And, of course, you can reach them through pajamasmedia.com. You can listen to this podcast at glennandhelenshow.com, or you can subscribe via iTunes. We like that. And you can always see updates at our blogs, instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com. Anyway, we hope you like it, and have fun on the Internet.
Talk to you next time.